Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm one of HRN's interns, Nina Medvinskaya, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week's topic? The marriage of food and danger. Sometimes, danger lurks in the food that we eat.
So instead of saying what is poisonous, I'd rather say what's not, because it's literally just the flesh and the fins.
Food poisoning doesn't just threaten our bodies, but it endangers our environment as well.
The emissions of JBS, combined with the other top five meat companies, exceed the annual emissions of Exxon, Shell, or BP.
For more, tune into this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there. This is a recommended reading with Food Book Fair, hitting you on the airwaves from Heritage Radio Network in the back of Roberta's. I am one of your co-hosts, Amanda Dell.
I'm your other co-host, Kimberly Chow.
We are the co-directors of Food Book Fair, a festival of writing about eating. And as I mentioned, your hosts for this fantastical, magical ride of recommended reading.
We'll be talking.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt,
in the engineer's booth. We're going to be talking about what we're reading, watching, and listening to between us, of course, but also we do it with friends and family in and around the food and media world. We are delighted to be on air with the celebrated chef today, Anita Lowe, who has now authored her second cookbook called Solo, A Modern Cookbook for a Party of One. In it, Anita gives us the ultimate guide to self-love through the best means possible, delicious food, and 101 accessible, contemporary, and sophisticated recipes for home cooks, drawn from her childhood, her years spent cooking around the world, and extensive travels. If you miss her beloved West Village restaurant, Anissa, you can listen on later to hear what she's up to and hear what's in this book and where you can get it.
No, not to delve too much into the book, but when I had a chance to take a look at it, I felt like I knew Anita a lot better.
Mm.
So
it's also beautifully illustrated by Julia Rothman, a past Food Book Fair event participant as well. And you should check it out. But we'll come back on the show later after the break to talk about it with Anita, so you get it from the source. But in the meantime, Amanda, what have you been reading, watching, or listening to? What's on your recommended list?
Thanks for letting me go first today. Well, I think I had mentioned last week or the week prior that I was very much looking forward to starting to read Michelle Obama's book, Becoming. Mm. And I was very conflicted about where to order it from and if I should just go to Jeff Bezos or, you know, support my local bookstore. I did buy it at a bookstore.
Where'd you go?
I went to the Barnes & Noble in Union Square.
Okay.
Not quite independent, but I figured it was a step in the right direction.
Mm.
And they do some good sales.
Mm-hmm.
I've just begun. It's a pretty lengthy book. I think it will probably take me through the Christmas break into the new year. And, you know, right now she starts from like day one, like where mm-hmm. she was born on the south side of Chicago, mm-hmm. her family dynamic, a lot about her brother, her parents' relationships, how she grew up, where she grew up, her schooling, family life in the Robinson home.
Mm-hmm.
And the parts that are really like getting me right now and are like giving me life is basically this section where I'm at right now where she meets Barack.
Mm.
And She is an associate on the partner track at a very prestigious Chicago law firm. And so she's, you know, a couple years ahead of Barack, although he is older, but took some time off. He is basically assigned to her. He is like a summer intern. Mm-hmm. And she is like his keeper, basically, and is supposed to like show him a good time so that he'll.
I mean, not in a
right
fraternizing way,
of course. Show him how great, you know, life can be working at this firm, and just give him like a sense of, you know, what the day to day would be like, and help guide him so that he can be most successful. You know, she Michelle is kind of a rule follower, as she, you know, self-proclaimed. And, you know, just reading these anecdotes from her just makes me like fall more and more in love with them as a couple and as people. Like, you know, she just basically said that, you know, Barack kind of Barack's reputation preceded him. Like he was talked about so much because really of, you know, his brilliance and that, you know, he could just like write like a 30-page, you know, memo on the criminal justice system, and everyone in the firm was like, wow, this is really good. Okay, so basically what the best part about it is, and it is that he doesn't care like about any of the shit that they want him to do during the summer, like outside of the office. Like,
yeah.
Michelle tries to like bring him to these like happy hours where people are like schmoozing and like talking about their like upwardly mobile lifestyle and how they're gonna like get a sob. And he could like honestly care less. She's like, yeah, I didn't bring him after like a couple. And then they go to the theater and they see Les Miserables. And like in intermission, he basically turns to her and is like, this kind of sucks. Like, should we get out of here? And she's like, what? I'm supposed to be like babysitting you. But she's like, okay. And so you can start to see where like the seeds of their romance are planted. And it's really funny. And you also kind of realize like eventually how complementary they are to each other. And I think that that's part of their strength together. Anyway, I'm very much looking forward to continuing, but it's really been a pleasure to read so far.
Something I love about the show, I was saying earlier, is the thematic continuity. Like, you'll mention, like, I'm trying to read Becoming, and two episodes later, you're like, this is where I am.
I'm a doer.
Or, like, other people recommend stuff, and then we pick it up.
Yeah. Okay, I will do a short one. Speaking of continuity, I've talked frequently about Guy Raz's show, How I Built This, another podcast, and I got a chance to listen to two podcasts by women entrepreneurs and founders, Bobbi Brown, and
she gives a great interview.
Just in general.
I've seen her speak and read a lot of interviews with her.
Yeah, and Emily Weiss from Glossier.
Oh yeah,
and you know, I think it's pretty safe to say that we're fans of Glossier. And, Emily's interview is like very kind of a matter of fact. Like she really like speaks very plainly about what she did and how she did it. And also is very open about the fact that she really didn't know what to do, how to do it. She's like Googling like venture capital. Like, what does that mean? And you know, Bobby's is really interesting because again I kind of like the ones that go back into like business development of like the 80s when people used like telephones more to actually call people. And there's always like that scene, like there's also like Barbara Corcoran's episode and like now Bobby Brown's episode where they're like literally like, I took the phone book, I started calling booking agents, like I called people, I said I would assist them. So just, you know, sometimes those practices don't apply today, but it's interesting to think about how you can translate them into today's world. It's inspiring. So those are my recommends.
Always pick up the phone and call. I feel like that's an Amanda Dell life recommend.
I feel like I do it less and less, but I'll put it back on my list. So what are you getting into these days, Miss Kim?
I have been traveling a lot. So I have different people who sublet my apartment or they house it. My cat, his name's Sam. He needs a lot of love. And often when people stay, they leave books, or other things, hopefully books. And hopefully ones I want to read. So I just read If Beale Street Could Talk by James Baldwin, which my summer subletter left for me, or maybe I bought for myself. It's unclear. We were both texting, and both of us read a lot of James Baldwin. So it was like unclear whose collection this came from. But it was sort of like a me Baldwin, Sue Baldwin sort of situation.
But you're in possession of it now.
I'm in possession of it now. I hear the film directed by Barry Jenkins is really good. I think another guest has recommended that. So I'm excited to check that out. It just came out.
Oh, it did officially
starring
come out.
Regina Hall.
Okay. Yeah,
who I really like. And then I'm reading Zaytoun by Dave Eggers, which is the story of a family during and after Katrina. And that came out several years ago. It won many awards. It's a nonfiction book written by Dave Eggers, who is better known for fiction, but told from the point of view of this family. But I did some Googling while I was on the train today because I was so engrossed in this story and I'm only 50 pages in. And I'm like, oh, I wonder what this family looks like in real life. And apparently the protagonist of this book was accused of trying to kill his wife a few years after the book came out.
Wow.
And now that's like the first page of Google Hits. And I'm like, holy shit.
But are they like...
By now I don't know what to do in terms of continuing to read this book or not.
Well, are they like united as a married couple?
No, they're divorced.
The book? Oh,
in the book. In the book, they're very much together. And
okay.
The book speaks really lovingly about their relationship and how they met and you know, all this stuff.
Wow. So it's a big turn, apparently.
Yeah.
Okay. I think you should...
I don't know if this is a spoiler. This book came out 10 years ago, and this was also like a major
crime. Feel like you should definitely keep reading it.
I mean, a storm is coming. I know that much. I know that much.
Right.
The main character is paddling a canoe on the front cover, which also tells you something. But I also read How to Kill a City recently by Peter Moskovitz, which talks about gentrification in four American cities, including New Orleans, after Katrina. So it's been interesting. I spent a little time there and a lot of friends live there, but not a lot of time there. And it's been interesting reading about this period of recent history.
That might be a book I might have to borrow.
How to Kill a City is... very good.
Is it in your lending library?
It's in... I just lent it out.
What?
Yeah.
Okay.
It talks about New York, San Francisco, Detroit, and New Orleans.
Okay.
You'll appreciate the New York chapter, I think.
Okay. I think I can get it from the library.
Yeah. So I'm reading that. I went to a friend's party this weekend, and she was playing her Spotify top hits list, which is basically what Spotify compiles for you.
Okay.
What you've been listening to all year. So I went home and I looked up mine, and it was less embarrassing than I thought it would be. There's a lot of Drake and Bad Bunny on it. Some Sade. It actually all flows together pretty nicely. Jidenna. I'm not embarrassed.
Okay.
But you should look.
My list would be like non-existent. I don't know. I just...
The internet has all of your information.
I know they do. And I know there was a headline like in the Times a couple of days ago about like location devices are like collecting all of your data. You don't think they're using it, but they are.
I think I always try to turn mine off, but I don't know.
Yeah. The one other thing I wanted to quickly talk about was, I don't know if you saw the article on Grub Street by Nikita Richardson about tipping.
Why tipping
failed.
Tip gratuity free didn't work.
Or it didn't work for many restaurants
that tried it.
We hosted
a town hall about labor and gratuity at Food Book Fair 2016 a lot of people were starting to make moves about that. That wasn't that long ago.
Right. It opens talking about Thad Vogler.
Okay. A previous recommended reading guest.
Exactly.
And about Bar Agricole and his business.
And Drew Normand and how he was like, he really, really was an early adapter of and felt very strongly about having service included.
Mm-hmm.
And like having to concede that it wasn't working was one of the most difficult things he's had to do. So the article itself is it's not really like conclusive, you know, it's just I think what I've been hearing a lot from people that have read it is really that this whole tipping, no tipping in the U.S., it kind of has to be a little bit more all in. It's kind of like when you're having certain restaurants that are outliers, you know, and still in the minority, it gets kind of, people don't know what to do. They don't know how to, like, compensating staff is still challenging. Guests don't know what to do. So I would recommend reading it.
So. I'll check it out. I saw it was on was on the top shared list and top most read.
Got it. Cool. Well, I think in a moment we are going to be joined by our guest, Anita Lowe. We're going to take a short break. Definitely want to let you know that we are in the end of year fundraising drive.
Woo!
Here at Heritage Radio Network. We need to raise some serious cash in order to keep these mics hot. So head over to heritageradionetwork.org. Please donate what you can. We are a member supported independent radio station, non-for-profit. So please give what you can so we can keep doing what we do.
2019 is HRN's 10th year. Help us make our most impactful and delicious year yet.
Do it.
heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and we will be back on Heritage Radio Network with Anita Lowe after this break.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit Korin.com.
Hello, welcome back.
Hi, you are listening to Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair and Heritage Radio Network. I'm Amanda Dell, your co-host.
I'm Kimberly Chow, your other co-host. We are joined today with the chef and author Anita Lowe. She has a new book out called Solo, a modern cookbook for a party of one. The life of a chef can be a lonely one with odd hours and late night meals. But as a result, Michelin-starred chef Anita Lowe believes that cooking and dining for one can and should be blissful and empowering, as the book description goes. We are so excited to be talking about that with Anita herself. Chef, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Hi, welcome.
We'd love to start right from the beginning. We really love how you explain it in the introduction and was wondering if you could say so in your words for our audience, how you came up with the concept of solo. You talk about putting the low in solo and in alone and the inspiration for this, which I love a pun. So we both do. So you're in good company here.
You know, actually the idea didn't come up that way. It came up because of a conversation I had with my friend David Ransom, who helps to organize the Share Breast and Ovarian Cancer fundraisers that we do every year. And for some reason, we got on the subject of cookbook titles with my last name in it.
Okay, oh, I read that part in the back, yeah. Like Sweet and Low, yeah. Like or something to that effect.
Yeah. Yeah, so two of the titles were Solo and Alone. I was like, oh my God, I have to write that. That would be really fun. And it could be, you know, the recipes have to be easy, so that could be easy for me too. And Yeah, it took a couple of years to get it out, but we finally did it.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah.
I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, love that concept. But also, I think this idea that cooking for yourself and enjoying a meal by yourself can be empowerful and blissful, as you say, is so powerful, and you really believe that. And it, I think this is also a moment in time where people in general, and it's being talked about more in mainstream media, are placing an import on self-care and taking care of themselves first. Do you think that's, how do you see this book or your engagement as maybe part of this larger cultural shift or indicative of that at all?
Oh, definitely. Certainly. I think food is culture, it's identity, and, you know, cooking for yourself and cooking what you love, cooking what you grew up with, can be self-reaffirming, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I loved in the beginning of the book that you said, like, that you had been broken up with so many times, or weren't
in a... It's true.
Like, and it kind of, like, forced you a little bit to, you know, always be, you know, at different points in your life, be cooking, you know, just for yourself. And maybe can you a little bit talk about your at one point your two different worlds, like restaurant cooking, where you're cooking for so many people every night, and then kind of your, you know, version of home cooking, where you might be cooking for yourself or your, you know, or another person. How did those two worlds meet, and you know, where did they divide, kind of?
Well, I think I started out actually cooking, you know, just for one, for the most part. I think, you know, I don't see how, yeah, it's shocking to me that there's so many people out there that have never really cooked for themselves. It's just
right.
Like when I went away to college, you know, I mean, most people leave home at one point. I figure, you know, I don't know. And you're not always coupled up. So, especially nowadays, you're not necessarily always, mm-hmm. even if you're coupled up, you're not necessarily with somebody every night. So I started cooking for myself in college because I had to. And, I really loved it. And that's actually how I ended up cooking professionally.
Mm.
So that really was the beginning. I think cooking professionally has only enhanced the way I cook from, you know, cook for one or cook for myself at home or for others at home. Yeah.
What were some of the things that you first learned how to cook when you were on your own for the first time away at college? And is there anything that you've retained in original or adapted form later on in life?
Oh, yeah. It's interesting because now that I don't have the restaurant, I'm cooking a lot more at home.
Mm.
And, so I'm actually going back to some of those recipes because I used to never cook in my apartment in New York City because it's just too small. And it's not, you know, I've got minimal counter space. And so it's not great. So what I would like to cook here is really just the most simple, you know, the simplest recipes. And so, yeah, I think some of the things that I started cooking when I went away to college were dishes that my family used to serve us, which was, you know, my nanny's chicken paprikash. I made that again recently. I made, you know, my mom sent me away to school with a little plastic index card holder of recipes.
Mm.
And,
do you still have that?
No, I lost. Oh. I don't know where it went, and it kills me. But yeah, it was like she had like a mapo tofu in there.
Mm.
I think there was some noodles. Her chicken curry when she grew up in Malaysia.
Mm.
I've been making stuff like that actually.
Yeah, one thing that really struck me about the book is. How global, you know, the influences are and how the recipe, you know, some of the recipes are drawn on, you know, time spent in Italy or Greece or Jerusalem. How do you kind of call the best things or the best recipes when you travel? And is it just sometimes you're inspired to make those recipes when you just can't stop thinking about them anymore? Or how do you bring those back and then, you know, start cooking them here?
Yeah, I mean, it's all of that, and it happens in different ways. And sometimes you just have something that you really love in a foreign country, and you come home and you either recreate it from memory or, you know, you have to go and do some research and figure out how to make that. And either you make that dish or you make a modified dish or, but I grew up in a really food obsessed family that traveled a lot. So, anytime we were going somewhere, we were trying to learn about that local culture through its food.
Mm. Okay, food obsessed. That's how you would describe your family growing up.
Absolutely, yeah.
And was that kind of different from how other families were at the time? Or, you know, did you feel like it was cool? Like you were happy that your family was food obsessed?
Well, I loved food, so I was happy that my family was food obsessed. But yes, we were different. We were, you know, I grew up in the Midwest. So there certainly were plenty of people in the Midwest that just, you know, ate for sustenance.
Mm-hmm.
But also we were eating, you know, weird things that nobody else was eating. And that was, on some level, you know, when you're a kid, you know, you want to fit in. And
oh,
so,
for sure.
As much as I loved those things, it was just, you know, it was something that I kept to myself
mm-hmm.
back then.
I'm also someone who grew up culturally Chinese in the Midwest. I think we're both from Michigan, actually. So I can imagine.
Yeah.
Where are you
from?
I'm from, I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit.
Oh, yeah, so did I. I grew up in Birmingham.
Okay, I grew up in Troy. So we're basically adjacent town neighbors.
There you go.
my family, we used to drive to Toronto, or rather Markham, Ontario, just to eat. And we would stay overnight and drive back.
Exactly. Actually, we would go. There was a really great restaurant in Windsor
Which one in Windsor?
I don't remember, but it was like they didn't. I remember they didn't have a liquor license, so they would serve beer in little tea pots.
That's brilliant.
And it just was like the best food ever.
Chinese people are so crafty.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I love those. I think I love those memories specifically of like going somewhere because of the food or bring like the specific memories you bring back, or sometimes recipes that are integrated into the rest of your life are because of food culture. And I feel like especially sometimes when you're living in a place or being brought up in a place that is where that's not necessarily the case, it feels so much more robust when you can access it in different ways.
Agreed, yeah.
I feel like this book is also deeply philosophical in the head notes.
But also really funny. There are two things that really struck me. One, I think
Is it the Arctic Char recipe?
No, I'll tell you. It's a lot of cookbooks, I think, describe themselves as being like, for the quote-unquote home cook.
Mm-hmm.
But in actuality, you know, there's like sometimes you need a lot of equipment or some of the ingredients are a little bit obscure or it does require like, you know, some practice and technique before you're able to achieve, you know, the recipes. But what I really felt like was like, wow, like every recipe that I flipped through in this book was like, okay, I do cook a lot personally, but I was like, I can definitely make this. And like, okay, I never thought about tahini and dates together in that way. I know, you know, I definitely know they're paired, you know, together, but it really felt very accessible for the home cook.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's certainly, I think in order to cook multiculturally, you have to be able to go get some weird ingredients, but all of that stuff you can get online these days. And, you know, I think it's better to present something multicultural than something watered down that, you know, that anyone can make from their local grocery store in, you know, Birmingham, Michigan, or whatever. Yeah.
Sorry, Birmingham, Michigan. Not sorry.
Yeah. Were there any recipes?
I have in the back. Maybe it's all new, but...
Were there any recipes that kind of like ended up on the cutting room floor, so to speak? Like, were there any recipes that you wanted to include, but maybe your editorial team didn't agree, or you recipe tested them a little bit, and was there something and it didn't work out? Were there any recipes that didn't make it in?
yeah. Let me think. There was a.
I'm always curious about that part.
Yeah, for some reason. I think I had a schnitzel somewhere that I didn't end up using. I didn't think. I mean, it was fine. I don't know, but in any cookbook, there's always some recipes that aren't, you know, that you know. I mean, every single recipe you stand by, but it, you know, some you love more than others. But that one, yeah, I don't remember what I had with it. But yeah, that one didn't make it. But I don't know why it didn't make it.
Okay. And then what was there? Speak with us a little bit about the decision to use Julia Rothman to do your illustrations and not having photography. Like, was that something that, you know, as this was your second book, like something that you had envisioned, or, you know, how did that decision get made?
Actually, my editor, Lexi Bloom, suggested it. And, okay. You know, immediately when she said that, I was like, that's brilliant. I think it goes with the tone of the book. And, yeah, and you know, I mean, as some people have pointed out, it's when you're cooking at home, you wanted to drive home that it didn't have to be perfect. You know, it doesn't have to look like, you know, when you do food photography, a lot of times it's just sort of like these idealized versions of what you're making, and it makes it that much more intimidating.
Wow, that's an excellent point I never thought of. Yeah, of course. Like, whenever I'm, like, pulling up a recipe or, you know, on New York Times Cooking and trying to do something, yeah, your mind, just as a human, you're always like, oh, I want to make it look like the picture. But then when you kind of take, when you take that out of the equation, you're a little more freeform, and you're also really concentrating on, you know, technique and taste.
Yeah, exactly.
Also,
and, you know.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, no one, you know, you're the only one looking at it, so.
True.
But, yeah, Julie Rothman, I love her stuff. It's so, I was really happy to do this, and I was so excited not to have to go through a long photo shoot. And
I love the author photo of you, as well as the portrait of Mr. Ping, the noodle soup chef who happens to be a duck in Kung Fu Panda.
I don't think
I've ever seen another cookbook where there is a duck noodle soup chef wearing Chinese dress illustrated.
Well, that was from Kung Fu Panda.
I haven't seen that movie, but I'm not how.
Oh my god, you have to see.
Okay.
It. It's the best movie.
So it's the duck and his son is a panda. I love it.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I love it.
Yeah.
Multi-special. Love can exist in many forms, and family
exactly.
can too.
Yeah, there's also so much humor in the book, which I wasn't quite expecting. One page that really made me laugh out loud was kind of like the Valentine's recipe, when you were describing kind of some of your when you were the chef at some of your earlier restaurants, how you really like flexed with your Valentine's menu, and it had hearts and it had things that were red. And then you presented in your book, like a recipe for like a single broken egg with like wilted, I think I earmarked it, Kim. Kim,
I feel like yes, you're, I see it.
Anyway, you know, why was it important to kind of bring humor to this book?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, cooking for just yourself or eating by yourself, there's something culturally taboo about it.
Mm.
So you kind of have to make fun of it, I think.
Mm.
And then there's all those, you know, yeah, I don't know. I mean, when I told, I remember I was at the Cher Bresner Ovarian Cancer fundraiser this year, and I was with a group of chefs, and yeah, they're asking me what I was doing now, and I said I came out with this book, and they're like, "Oh, what is it?" And I said, "You know, it's cooking for one," and they all laughed.
Oh no!
So they found it funny right away, which is good.
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, "Oh my god!" Yeah, it's like fine, but yeah, clearly there's a need. So I don't feel bad.
Yeah, it's like cooking. You know, I think people are, you know, it's like cooking is like, you know, holiday meals and big gatherings. And, you know, I think that's what people are associating with quote unquote, you know, cooking or like something, you know, a cookbook is has to be more special occasion. So again, like we you know, really appreciate a book that, you know, is intended for, you know, doing something more by, you know, by yourself. It doesn't have to be celebratory. It's your own celebration.
It's your own. It's a party, exactly. Party of one. It's a modern party of one.
Right.
Are there any books that you're reading, cookbooks or otherwise, speaking of books?
Yeah, I've got two books that I'm reading right now. Well, I actually took a break from, I started this other book that someone gave me, but I was reading, Buttermilk Graffiti by
the Edward Lee book. Yeah,
he gave it to me. We were at a an event in Arkansas, and he gave it to me then. And I was like, "Oh my God, who knew?" It's so well done. I'm really excited about it. And now I'm also reading Let the Great World Spin by Colin McCann.
That's a great New York City book.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. So I just started it, and yeah, exciting.
I was lucky enough to see him read once a while ago, and he read different excerpts of the book in different voices based on the changing characters, which is quite interesting.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, it's a book that makes you sort of stop and reread passages, which is cool. Yeah.
Do you find yourself drawn to other cookbooks or fiction, nonfiction, other forms of media when you are, you know, spending time celebrating yourself?
Yeah. I love fiction. I love fiction. I try to read as much as I can. And I love cookbooks. I have a million cookbooks. I've been told I'm going to die under an avalanche of cookbooks in my little tiny apartment eventually. I mean, I look like a hoarder. I've got like piles of them because my shelf space has been used up. But
that sounds like our fantasy.
Yeah, I think we can relate.
And I thought after I escaped, you know, after I called Denise, I'd stop buying them. But then, you know, they just keep on calling, and I'm like, oh, I need this.
Are there any new cookbooks or food-related books that have come out this year, or ones that have been that are new to you recently that you recommend?
Well, I just got the last three ones that I have received. The Food of Taiwan by Kathy Irwin,
A fellow Heritage Radio Network host. Yes.
That's a great book.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. I'm excited for, and that she gave me that one. Kian Lam Ko gave me the Phoenix Pause and Jade Trees, which I'm excited about. And I went to Mark Vetri's pizza pop up at Raja the other day, and I got Mastering Pizza, which is something I'm really excited about because I just put in a wood burning oven in my house last year.
Nice.
Out in Long Island.
Oh, cool.
And I really would like to be able to make some pizza for myself. I haven't quite, you know, figured it out yet.
But I feel like pizza is a perfect solo food. You eat some then and you have some for later. Like you just
absolutely,
or you have
yeah.
pizza by yourself.
Yeah. Wait, Mark Vetri did a pizza pop up at Raza?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Last week?
So,
wow, how was it?
Yeah. It was amazing.
Oh my gosh, that sounds like a dream.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we had like four different kinds of pizzas or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
So, I mean, it was sort of like a, you know, it was like a book dinner.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I was like, I definitely lifted my PATH train ban to go to Raza, and it was really good.
Yeah, I mean, it's a 20, you know, I should go. I don't think about it because it's, you know, it's across, it seems far, but it's 20 minutes from my house.
You got to cross state lines to eat this food.
Exactly, yeah. I love it, yeah. Ooh. Best pepperoni I've ever had.
Yeah, and you know, so in the book you also mention oftentimes some friends, you know, other chefs, and you've kind of been inspired to put to include recipes or adapted recipes, like Amanda Cohen's taco recipe, which, you know, I found really refreshing, because it's felt to me a little bit lately that there isn't, I know that there is an intense camaraderie that exists among chefs, but sometimes when you're in a, you know, working on a cookbook, you want to have like your own proprietary recipes that, you know, are just your own. And I really liked it when you said, you know, this is a, I love going to eat Amanda Cohen's, you know, Brussels sprouts tacos, but this is kind of like my version that's a little simpler.
Yeah, I mean, this book isn't necessarily about me. It's like, I guess my first cookbook was more, you know, calling card. Okay. It had to more define you. This one, you know, this is for the home cook, so it's not, you know, a lot of these recipes aren't even creative. So, like, I've got like Singapore noodles. You know, I mean, I didn't do anything to that. It was just calibrated for one person. You know.
Cool. Yes, that recipe definitely caught my eye as well. We are running a little short on time, so maybe you could leave us with, like, if I was going home for dinner tonight and I could just stop at my regular store, what should I make from Solo tonight?
It depends on what you're feeling like.
Oh, give me your greatest hits. What should I? Okay, it's kind of cold. It's cold, but not super cold in New York today, I would say. So maybe I like a lot of vegetables.
Okay, make some ochazuke.
Okay, I've never made that before. Right. What is that?
So it's basically like a dashi tea that you pour over rice. It could be old rice. I mean, yesterday's rice or whatever. Or it could be new rice. I usually make it with brown rice because I like the sweetness of it. And you put, you know, various things on top. I love to put, you know, some fish. I think in the book I just have like an avocado one, like mm-hmm. a simple one.
Avocado sunshine.
Delish. That looks really good. Have an avocado at home, so.
Perfect. You can have your tea and eat it too.
I was waiting to say that. Well, Chef, thank you so much for joining us today. Again, we have had a wonderful time with Chef Anita Lowe. She has a brand new cookbook. It's called Solo. What is the tagline?
Solo, a modern cookbook for a party of one.
It certainly has been a party today. You can find it anywhere where cookbooks are sold. And again, Chef Anita, thank you so much for joining us on Recommended Reading.
Yeah, great talking to you.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be having a party tonight by ourselves or with others. We'll see what happens.
Also, these recipes are easily multiplied. So listeners, if you want to party with more than one, you can do that as well. We'll talk to y'all soon. And in the meantime, this is Recommended Reading. And it's been two of us here, Kim
and Amanda.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Recommended Reading is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
everybody. I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.